Humanity is in trouble. Some of us are here to help. Together, we will take the next step.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the Next Step podcast. I hope you are doing well. So for today, we are going to get into the first of two episodes that will feature Mortimer Adler. This episode will almost entirely feature Mortimer Adler, and in the next episode, you will hear a lot less of him and more of myself. He's going to be talking about the great idea of labor and its relation to the pursuit of leisure, and then also the role that liberal education plays in talking about these ideas. My next episode will bring you into my understanding of the liberal education model. And so I know liberal education to me has always sounded like a really dry, boring pursuit of old white men. And only in the past year and a half or so have I realized that there's actually a lot more to it, and that the model of liberal education as it is something that can be refreshed within each generation. So while it might have meant something to previous generations, it holds a certain kind of promise and potential for our own generation here in the 21st century. So, so if you want to know more about that, then you're going to have to tune into the next episode. So for this episode, it's just going to be Mortimer Adler talking about labor and distinguishing that from rest and play and leisure. Basically, to distinguish leisure from the others is to introduce a certain way of looking at how we spend our free time. And that's it's something that I think is very important to the audience here, because we talk a lot about, you know, alternatives to spending our free time, basically, on this show. You know, looking at permaculture, transition towns, circle organizations, World Cafe process, even turning inward into spiritual alchemy and stuff like that. You know, these are basically, I'm providing you with different ways to go about spending your free time, you know, when you're not working, and then even to move towards a sort of career path that is more leisurely, as you will come to understand the term. So, again, if anything, this is just good food for thought. Okay, now I mentioned this was the great idea of labor, and what that has to do with is Mortimer Adler's work on the great books of Western civilization. And to get on this list of great books, it required a certain amount of great ideas to be contained within the books. So things like Plato and Karl Marx and Freud, you know, these scored very high on the amount of great ideas they contained, and so were certainly included in the Great Books series. But, you know, essentially the great ideas are very simple ideas that, well, seemingly simple ideas, very universal ideas, things that all human beings deal with throughout their life. So to kind of just explain this concept of the great ideas more in its relation to philosophy and everyday life, I'm going to read a short essay Adler wrote called Philosophy is Everybody's Business. And he says, it cannot be too often repeated that philosophy is everybody's business. To be a human being is to be endowed with a proclivity to philosophize. To some degree, we all engage in philosophical thought in the course of our daily lives. Acknowledging this is not enough. It is also necessary to understand why this is so and what philosophy's business is. The answer, in a word, is ideas. In two words, it is great ideas. The ideas basic and indispensable to understanding ourselves, our society, and the world in which we live. These ideas, as we shall see, constitute the vocabulary of everyone's thought. Unlike the concepts of the special sciences, the words that name the great ideas are all words of ordinary, everyday speech. They are not technical terms. They do not belong to the private jargon of a specialized branch of knowledge. Everyone uses them in ordinary conversation. But everyone does not understand them as well as they can be understood, nor has everyone pondered sufficiently the questions raised by each of the great ideas. To think one's way through to some resolution of the conflicting answers to these questions is to philosophize. The Great Ideas program aims to do no more than to provide some guidance in this process. I am limiting the consideration of these ideas to an elementary delineation that will try to achieve three results for you. First, it should give you a surer grasp of the various meanings of the word you use when you talk about the idea, such as labor, for instance. Second, the delineation of each idea should make you more aware than you normally are of the questions or issues that you cannot avoid confronting if you are willing to think a little further about the idea. Basic ones, ones that human beings have been arguing about over the centuries. And third, in the consideration of each idea, we are led to the consideration of other ideas. How does our understanding of truth affect our understanding of goodness and beauty? How does our understanding of what is good and bad carry us not only to an understanding of what is right and wrong, but also to an understanding of justice? And how does that affect our understanding of liberty and equality as well? If I succeed in these aims, I will have helped you engage in the business of philosophy, which is everybody's business, not only because nobody can do much thinking, if any at all, without using the great ideas, but also because no special technical competence of the kind that is required for the particular sciences and other special disciplines is required for thinking about the great ideas. Everybody does it, wittingly or unwittingly. I hope I am right in believing that everyone would wish to do it just a little better. Okay, so that's just a basic context for understanding this discussion of the great idea of labor. You know, Mortimer Adler, although he was really smart and, you know, certainly had a lot to say that was very complex, he also worked very hard in trying to simplify these things and make them more approachable for just the everyday person. Because as he says here in this essay, it's everybody's business to do philosophy. You know, it's something that is part of having an intellect, which is part of being a human being. As far as we know, no other creature on the planet does have an intellect or the ability to understand these sorts of ideas in the way that we do, these high-level abstract thinking skills. So that's where we're at here in discussing the idea of labor. It's just part of a greater introduction to philosophy that Mortimer Adler provides, but I'm using it for the purposes of relating it to some of the things I talk about on this show, and in specific, his own segue into liberal education after discussing the ways in which we spend our free time. So this audio came from the DVD series on labor, which is part of the Great Ideas series, and I obtained it from the Center for the Study of the Great Ideas, co-founded by Mortimer J. Adler and Max Wiseman. So if you want to know more about that and maybe even join up there, get a membership, or just you know, donate some money and receive some great gifts like this DVD and others, you can go to www.thegreatideas.org. It's a nonprofit, so you don't actually buy anything from them, but donations do come with some gifts at times. So I highly recommend the series on labor if you're interested in what you hear today. This is only about the second half of it. You missed the first half, which is just, it would distract away from what I'm really trying to get at here. But it's interesting nonetheless, extremely fascinating. And you can also get this entire series on the great ideas that Mortimer Adler did in the book How to Think About the Great Ideas, which is where I first encountered this talk on labor. Now keep in mind, this material was put together by Adler and his people in 1953 and 1954. It only aired, I believe, in San Francisco, which is a shame, but it was, you know, current at that time. And while it does sound a bit dated now, I find personally that a lot of what he says is extremely relevant today, you know, almost 60 years later. But keep that in mind. He's talking in the mid-1950s here. And some of the things he says towards the end, I think, are a bit eye-opening. So I'll have a few brief closing remarks at the end, but other than that, I leave you with Mr. Mortimer Adler.
Good afternoon. Mr. Luckman and I welcome you to another discussion of the great ideas. We want to thank you for the many fine questions, some of which we have selected to consider this afternoon. I wish, Lloyd, that we had time to handle all of them because they are so good. As we go on this afternoon with the discussion of labor, I would like to remind you of the point in the discussion at which we stopped last week. And so I'd like to take you back to that homemade chart I used last week at the end and pick up that point in a quick summary of it. The chart showed leisure as being something in between, something intermediate between work and play. Because leisure activities, like play, when play is amusement, involves freedom of choice. We can do it or not do these things as we please. In the case of play, we have no obligation to play whatsoever. But leisure is also something like work. For though we have freedom with respect to the things we ought to do in matters of leisure activity, nevertheless we have some obligation to ourselves to perform these leisure activities insofar as they are the occasions by which we grow morally, spiritually, intellectually. And the question with which I ended last time about the shadowy line that there is between work and leisure, I gave only one answer to last time. The answer that this chart indicates, that leisure is something like work and something like play, and so tends to be sometimes confused with work or labor. But there is a deeper answer to that question, an answer, by the way, that one person who wrote us a letter and sent us a question saw right into. Lloyd, you remember the question from Mr. Thompson? An excellent question. I would like to have you read it for us.
Well, here it is. Mr. Thompson lives in Walnut Creek, and he wrote, "Since both leisure and work can be characterized by the element of obligation, and since leisure activities are motivated by moral obligation, but work is motivated both by moral obligation and the need for physical subsistence. Therefore, cannot the desirability of work be assessed by the proportion of the compulsion that is moral? Or, as he says, to put it more simply, is not work the more virtuous, the less it is simply a matter of biological survival? Cannot this standard be used to measure all the shades of work from drudgery to sheer paid leisure?"
As I said, Lloyd, that's an extraordinarily good question, and it's more than a question, because what Mr. Thompson's done here is to give us the answer to the question, and the answer contains a great deal of insight about work and leisure, particularly about the shades of work, as use his phrase. They shade, let me repeat what he said, they shade from me at one extreme to what he calls sheer paid leisure at the other. That, by the way, Mr. Thompson, is a wonderful phrase you invented, sheer paid leisure. And I take it what you mean by that phrase, I'd like to see if I explained it correctly, is that these activities you call sheer paid leisure are the kind of things that you and I would do, that men would do, even if they didn't need to be paid, even if they didn't need compensation. They are like leisure activities, even though, as a matter of fact, someone gets paid for doing them. Now, there are two points, I think, in your insight, Mr. Thompson. And I was so struck by it that I did another chart at home that I brought with me, and I'd like to see if I can convey your insight to all the rest of the people involved in listening or watching this program by expounding it a little further. Let me show you another chart that I think contains Mr. Thompson's insight explained a little more. He says there are two kinds of obligation. Moral obligation, to do the things that improve us, that make us grow, and the biological necessity we have of working for a living, to earn the things that keep us alive. And the kind of going along with moral obligation is the intrinsic reward of satisfaction, whereas the kind of activity that is biologically necessary, we have to be extrinsically compensated for. And he says between these two extremes, there are all the shades of work from drudgery at one extreme to what he calls share paid leisure at the other. There, rising from the bottom to the top, one would get the various gradations of work in proportion as they involve more and more intrinsic reward and moral obligation to do them, because they were the kind of activities that improved us. Now, it seems to me that this is an extremely clear point, and I hope that as we go on this afternoon, we shall be able to develop it even more fully. But first, I would like to make one preliminary remark. One thing that occurs to me as I look at a chart of that kind is that one and the same activity can be work or play or leisure. For example, consider dancing or football. For some men and women, dancing is recreation or play. But for professional dancers, it's work. Take football. For many boys in school and college, I hope at least that football is play, not work. But there are some, and there certainly are professional football teams, for whom playing football is work. Or consider such things as gardening and carpentry. Many, many men, many human beings do both of these things, gardening and carpentry, as part of their leisure activities. And yet there are men who work at gardening and work at carpentry. Or consider teaching and music. These two are things that for some people are leisure activities, and others earn their living while engaged in performance of these tasks. And finally, there is learning, which, as I said last time, is really work for children, and for adults, it should not be work, but should be one of the highest uses of leisure.
Dr. Adler.
Yes, Lloyd.
This last remark of yours about learning or study being work for children makes this, I think, an appropriate place to consider a question by Judith Poole of Jackson Street here in San Francisco. Her question reads, since children are incapable of true leisure activity, should the wise parent train a child for future leisure by presenting such pursuits, that is, learning, as play or as work? Since obligation to a child implies work and freedom implies play, which of these should receive the emphasis during the childhood in order to develop a better adult?
Well, I think that my answer will run somewhat contrary to the intention of Miss Poole's question. In my judgment, learning in childhood should be work, not play. It should prepare the child for the kind of work he has to do in adult life. Learning, I think, Lloyd, is the most serious obligation of childhood and is the equivalent of the obligation to work in adult life. In childhood, play should be the prototype of leisure. And there, I think, is where we tend to make our great mistake. We think that the play of the child should be entirely fun or amusement. Some of it certainly should be that. But some of the play the child does should be like leisure, intrinsically beneficial and not merely fun or amusement. Now, we've received, Lloyd, a lot of questions from boys and girls in college and school who keep asking about whether learning is work or play. And I think, at least I hope that by now, this answer is clear, that for children, it is work. And as one becomes more and more an adult, learning becomes less and less work and more a form of leisure. And anyone can decide for himself just how much of a child or how much of an adult he is by this test.
Well, I'd agree that you've answered the questions that have come from the college students who've asked if the kind of studying they're doing is work or leisure. But, and I take it, too, that you think that students should be adult enough to regard their study as a leisure time activity. But I'm not so sure that you fully answered this question, the one we've received from Frederick Rohr of San Mateo Junior College. Mr. Rohr wants to know whether schools and teachers should always try to make learning fun, when, as he puts it, students should realize that learning involves hard work, disagreeable work, and as again he writes, difficulties to be overcome is the essence of learning.
Mr. Rohr, I think I said something last time that I would like to remind you of, that is partly an answer to your question. I said last time that work, the work we do for compensation, is not the only hard, difficult, painful, or disagreeable thing we do in life. Thinking is hard and painful and difficult, and much learning is this. And there's no reason to call something work simply because it involves pain or effort and some difficulty. I think it's wrong to regard learning or studying as work simply because of that fact. That tends to confuse the distinction that I hope we can keep clear between work and leisure. Now I'm going to see if I can make the distinction a little clearer, as well as show you why there is a shadowy line between work and leisure. Let me go on with the discussion at this point, Lloyd. And I would like to begin getting into this further development of the insight that partly we got from Mr. Thompson by making two distinctions. One that Adam Smith made in his great work on the Wealth of Nations, between productive and non-productive labor. And then secondly, what I think is a deeper distinction than that, between servile and liberal work. Now, Adam Smith's distinction is between the kind of work that produces economically valuable goods and services, whereas what he called non-productive labor or work produced only non-economic services. The services of the ministry, the services of the physician, the services of the teacher, the services of the government official. These have no economic value, and therefore he called them non-productive work. Now, what interests me about this distinction is something that may not have occurred to you. We have a lot of different names for the ways in which men get paid or compensated for what they do. We speak of wages and salaries. And wages, by the way, there's a distinction between wages and salaries. Wages, I think you'll see, are the kind of pay one gets for a fairly low grade of work, productive work. Salaries are paid to men who do work that may involve a little leisure. And as one gets to the kind of work that is higher in the scale of work, we don't use the word wages and salaries at all. We talk of paying fees to a physician. We talk of honoraria to artists and lecturers. As a matter of fact, we ought to talk about fees and honoraria to teachers, not salaries. And finally, when we come to the priesthood or the ministry, we talk about the priest or the minister as having a living, not even a fee or an honorarium. I think these words that suggest different kinds of payment also suggest something about the kinds of work. And so I turn to the second distinction, which will make even clearer, I hope, the grades of work from one extreme to the other, from the extreme of servile work at one end to the extreme of liberal work at the other. To suggest to you what is involved here, let me show you some pictures of men at work. And as you look at these pictures of men at work, keep before you the question, are all these pictures of men doing work in the same sense of work? Or to put the question another way, are they all doing the same kind of work? Now, that first picture you looked at is the picture of, was a picture of coal miners. And then you are now seeing a picture of machinists at work in a machine shop. Then there's the picture of a commercial artist at his job. We turn from that to the picture of surgeons operating in a hospital. And finally, we come to the picture of a priest administering the last rites. I ask my question again. Are all these men working? Are they doing the same kind of work? And to give an answer to that question, I would like to define for you the two extremes between which all human work falls. At one extreme, I say, we have the kind of work that should be called drudgery. Completely servile work. It is like the thing we call last time chores, except that in this case, it is compensated. It is the kind of work that is repetitious day after day, that is stultifying to the human spirit, and that no one would do except for the compensation. No one would choose to do this if he could possibly avoid it and gain a living in some other way. At the other extreme, we have the kind of work which, do you recall last time Mrs. Brodersen used the phrase, labor of love, Lloyd? The kind of work I would like to call a labor of love. The kind of work which is completely liberal, therefore. It is varied from day to day. It is self-improving rather than stultifying. And it is the kind of activity that a human being would perform or engage in even if he did not get compensated. Even if he had a living from some other source, he would still do this kind of thing because it's exactly like leisure, self-rewarding, intrinsically satisfying. Now, all the shades of work fall between these two extremes of drudgery at the bottom and labors of love at the top. I have another one of my homemade charts to show you this picture. Here it is. At the bottom, we have the kind of work I call sheer drudgery. Repetitive, stultifying, done only for compensation. Wouldn't be done except to earn a living. At the very top of the chart, I have what is not work at all. Leisure activities, characterized by their variety, their being intrinsically beneficial, things done for their own sake. And very close to leisure activities are the kind of work or working jobs that I call labors of love, which, like leisure activities, are varied and beneficial and would be done for their own sake, even though, in fact, we may be compensated for them. The kind of thing Mr. Thompson called sheer paid leisure. Now, all work is in a scale between those two. And as one goes up the scale, one gets work that is more and more liberal. As one comes down the scale, one gets work that is more and more servile. As I say, everyone's job, everyone's way of earning a living involves some of the liberal, some of the servile, some aspect of leisure, some aspect of drudgery. And if you were to ask me whether you could tell in your own life, in your own job, in your own working day, what kind of a working job you had, how much of leisure was in it, how much of drudgery, I can give you two criteria for answering your own question. Ask yourself about the importance of the compensation. Would you keep on doing it if you didn't need to earn a living? If you stopped tomorrow, if you had a living provided you, then I say there's a lot of drudgery in it. If you would go on doing it, even though you had a fortune before you, then I say there's a great deal of leisure in it. There's a second criterion. How much do you watch the clock? If the time of the working day is sharply divided from free time, the time left over play and leisure, and you look at that clock and want the working day to come to an end, then it's full of drudgery. But if in your life the line between the working day and the leisure hours is a shadowy line, almost doesn't exist, then your work goes right into leisure. I would say, for example, if I may speak for you as well as for me, Lloyd, that we are very fortunate being teachers, leading that kind of working life, because I'm sure that, I really feel sure for both of us, that were we enabled to, with an income of private fortune, not to have to earn a living, we probably would go on doing very much the same thing. Now, the hard part about it, and that's the good part, the hard part of it is I never know when my working day stops. My work goes right into my leisure activities so continuously that, in some sense, I have less free time. That's a silly thing to say. Of course, I have a great deal of free time. All my time may be free time if work and leisure are so inseparable, as I think they are when one gets up the ladder of work to work that is a labor of love.
Would you pause for a moment,
yes,
dear?
Lord?
I have a question I'd like you to answer. It's from Mr. Keechy in Berkeley, and we discussed it, I think, in this connection, too. He writes, in view of your statement that work is done only to secure a livelihood, is it wrong or fallacious to try to motivate workers by appeals to pride, to craftsmanship, and to competition?
Not at all, Mr. Keechy. Those motivations are good motivations, but let me add a warning. Too many employers use them in a hollow and superficial manner. The motivation, pride and competition, feeling of workmanship, can't be made genuine, unless the work itself is worth doing. Unless the workman can really take pride in the work, have the feeling that Veblen describes as the instinct of workmanship, or the instinct of craftsmanship. It can't be faked. It has to be real. The work has to be good work, work worth doing. And this leads me to one comment on the whole labor problem that this, it seems to me, is the appropriate time to make. There really is no solution, and there never will be a solution, of the labor problem simply in terms of wages and hours. Men will always want more money and less time at work, so long as their work involves drudgery. And by the way, I'm sure we all agree this is so. There's nothing wrong with this either. If men have to do drudgery, and they want more money for it, and they want to do less of it. The only real solution of the labor problem, it seems to me, is in other terms than hours and wages. The real solution of the happiness of men at work, their satisfaction, is to make the work itself less drudgery and more intrinsically worthwhile, so that more and more it becomes liberal and a labor of love. Now, it's this last insight about the labor problem and the relation of the character of the work to the satisfaction of the workman that brings me to one of the great notions that really is born in our own day. You may be surprised at this, the phrase we use all the time, the dignity of labor, the dignity of all forms of labor, would have been unheard of, unthought of, 150 years ago. And as I said some weeks ago, talking about the difference between our society and all the previous societies, our industrial democracy and the pre-industrial or aristocracies of the past, in all these past societies, pre-industrial and aristocratic, there could be no meaning to the dignity of labor. In fact, the only thing that could have dignity would be leisure, because leisure was the occupation of free men. Labor could have no dignity, because labor was the occupation of slaves. For the first time in our society, an industrial democracy, which is in that sense a classless society, because all men are both working men and men of leisure, labor for the first time has dignity, because now for the first time, free men work. Men who are free in the sense of being men of leisure, men who are free in the sense of being citizens, are also men who work, and therefore work is dignified. And this is the social or external aspect of the dignity of labor. It's respectable now because free men do it, not just slaves. But there is also an inner and spiritual aspect to the dignity of labor that has to do with the character and the end of the work itself. Work has dignity internally and spiritually if it is the kind of work that is worth doing, if it has liberal elements and aspects of leisure in it. That's in terms of its character. That's worth doing for its own sake. And secondly, work has dignity in terms of the end or the goal of the work. To have intrinsic spiritual dignity, the end or purpose of the work must ultimately be the good of the workman or the good of society and not the private profit of another man. Now let me summarize this point for you in my final chart for today. I'd like to get this point quite clear because I think it's such an important point for all of us to understand. This word dignity is so important in anyone's life. What I've done in this chart is to compare the dignity of man and the dignity of labor. When we talk about the dignity of man, we say he has this dignity because he is master of himself, no man slave or servant. He has freedom. And we say he has dignity because he's treated as an end and never merely as a means. Now let me turn those two points over into the dignity of labor. We say labor has dignity when it has freedom in it. The freedom of contract, of hiring and taking one's job at one's own will or giving it up at one's own will. The freedom of choosing one's own occupation, one's own way of earning a living. This the slave cannot do. Freedom of contract and choice of occupation is part of the dignity of labor. But the other part comes from the end of the work and its character. It must be work that is worth doing for its own sake. And it must be work that is done ultimately for the good of the workman himself or the society in which he lives, and not just for the private profit of another individual. Now, I think that last point will help us as we go on next time to consider the moral, the political, and the economic consequences of our understanding of labor and leisure. But we have a little more time left. Lloyd, are there a few more questions we ought to consider?
No, not that I can think of, Dr. Adler. I think you've answered most of the questions that are relevant to today's discussion. I have here all the questions we received from college students about whether they're working when they study, and we've answered that. You've also answered the question whether the businessman who acts as a non-salaried chairman of a welfare agency is working or performing a leisure duty or activity. Yep. Then we have, well, this question, whether one and the same occupation involves elements of labor and leisure.
The answer to that has
that one is answered. And another question, whether the way in which a man earns a living may be for him almost completely like a leisure activity.
Labor of love.
Labor of love.
Yes. Yes.
And, no, those are all the questions I'd have to offer.
Well, I feel better than I did at the beginning, Lord. I was afraid that we had so many good questions that we might have to slide some of them. But I think maybe Mr. Luckman is right, and I hope he is, that today's consideration of labor and leisure answered in principle, at least, if not in detail, most of the questions we received. Now, next time, in the fourth Sunday on labor and leisure, as I said a moment ago, I want to look at the economic consequences of our understanding of labor and leisure. And then in the last Sunday of the month, I want to talk about education, liberal education in relation to work and leisure. I hope you will all again send in these excellent questions you've been turning into us. Thank you very much. Good afternoon. Mr. Luckman and I welcome you to another discussion of the great ideas. And this afternoon, to the discussion continuing on the idea of labor. I wonder whether you realize how much ideas are like seeds. If you plant them in good soil, take care of them, they will bloom and bear fruit. And I am hoping that we have planted well the ideas about labor and leisure we have been discussing in the last few weeks, and that this afternoon we can harvest some of the fruit in important consequences from our consideration of this basic idea. Now, there are two things that I should like to remind you from last time. One is the insight that we gained about the distinctions between work, labor, or work, play, and leisure. We saw that as we got these three basic notions clear, there were difficulties about applying them to particular cases. We learned that the same task, for example, may be a different sort of thing to different persons. To some, what to some is work may be to others leisure. What to some persons is drudgery, maybe to others a labor of love. And we saw that the line dividing work from leisure, or drudgery from more liberal work, is often shadowy, and only sometimes is it sharp. And we saw that it may be very difficult, however clear we are about these ideas, to classify some particular task or job that we have to do. I think this answers a great many of the questions that we received, Lloyd, in letters, questions that suggested that whether something was work or leisure, drudgery or a labor of love depended largely on the attitude one took, on the state of mind of the person occupied with the task. That does answer those questions, doesn't it, Lloyd?
Well, I would agree in general. I have those questions here. And yes, you've answered most of them, but this one, I think, puts particular emphasis upon a person's capacities or talents, and I'd like to put it to you. It's from Alan A. Coogan here in San Francisco. He asks, does not the classification of any particular task as drudgery, a labor of love, or leisure depend in part, at least, upon a person's capabilities?
Yes, I think that is another and an important factor. Mr. Coogan, I think I would say that a task becomes drudgery when it falls below the level of a person's abilities. For work to be good work and have some aspect of leisure in it, it must make the right demands on a person's abilities. It must be have some proportion to what his capacities are, and in fact, it must call upon them in such a way that it develops those capacities to the fullest. Now, the second point that we considered last time, of importance for us today, is the point about the dignity of labor. You will recall that we saw last time that the dignity of labor is established when free men work, when work is not just the occupation of slaves, and when work has some intrinsic value for the worker. And the most important thing we saw, I think, about this is how recently in human history has the dignity of labor been established? Have all forms of labor had dignity in the eyes of society and in the eyes of men? Now, in terms of these two main points that we covered last time, I should like to project for you the two main points we want to consider today. First, in terms of such clarity as we have gained about the different parts of life, work, play, and leisure, I would like to raise the question about how these parts of life should be ordered, how they should be related to one another. And second, in terms of our understanding of how recently in human history the dignity of all forms of human labor has been recognized, I would like to discuss with you the great revolution of our times, what in my view is the second great revolution in the history of mankind. Let me go back to the first point and deal with it now. Some of you who were with us in November when we discussed happiness and virtue will remember that happiness, as we considered it, seemed to consist in the possession of all good things, and that in order to come into possession of all good things, it was necessary to have a right ordering of the different goods. Now, that ordering of the different goods, I hope you will see today, is very closely related to a right ordering of the parts of life. So much so is this the case that I think that happiness itself can be defined very concretely in terms of labor and leisure and play as they are properly ordered in a good life. Now, it seems to me, I recall, Lloyd, that we had a letter from a Mr. Collignan that put the very question we want to answer. What is that? Would you read that question for us, Lloyd?
Well, I think your letter from Mr. Collignan is from Private Collignan, U.S. Army. And he lives here in San Francisco also. He puts your question as follows. Does one work for the sake of having free time, or does one have free time for the sake of work?
Well, I think if we do not distinguish between mere play and true leisure, the question could be answered either way. But suppose we do make the distinction that we've been trying to make between play and leisure, then it seems to me that we have to say the following thing. That play, as recreation, is like sleep. It is for work, and work, in turn, is for the sake of leisure. And in other words, seems to me, if you look at the summary, these things related another way, we have to live. We have to have the vitality of life itself in order to earn a living. And the whole purpose of earning a living is for the sake of living well, of enjoying life. I summarized the relation of these parts of human life in a chart which my son Mark prepared for me at home. Perhaps if we look at this chart, we can see all of these parts in relation to one another. I put them in three columns. First, the conditions of living itself, the conditions of being alive. Secondly, the conditions of earning a living. And in the third place, the conditions of living well. Now in the first column, sleep and all other similar biological activities, along with play as useful recreation, are the conditions of our being alive and having vitality. And these two conditions are for the sake of our being able to work so that we can earn a living, labor for commodities or for compensation. And along with labor, we already put again uncompensated chores. And these two things, labor, compensated labor, and the uncompensated chores we have to do, are for the sake of living well. And living well consists of the leisure pursuits in which we engage and the liberal work we do and some small amount of play itself as pleasant amusement. Now, in the light of this chart, I think we can see what the wrong order of the parts of life would be. Certainly, it would be wrong to sleep for its own sake. It would be wrong to play for its own sake, just to kill time or to escape boredom. I think the psychiatrist would tell you that a man who slept for its own sake or played for its own sake was indulging in not only escapism, but perhaps even a kind of suicidal neurosis. It's almost just as wrong to regard work as an end in itself instead of as a means. It certainly is wrong to regard work as something we do for the sake of play. And the third error we could make is to order the parts of our life in such a way that we omitted leisure activities from them entirely and used our free time simply for the sake of play. Now, I should like to summarize this in somebody else's terms than mine. These basic notions about the order of work and play and leisure in human life are very old in our Western civilization. I am repeating them here in the 20th century, but they were discovered and understood in the 5th and 4th century BC, and I think perhaps better understood then, for some of us today have tended to forget them. I would like to read you some short passages from Aristotle's Ethics and Politics, where in the discussion of happiness, he makes these fundamental points very simply and very well. First, I would like to read you a passage from the Ethics, in which he says, "Happiness does not lie in amusement. It would indeed be strange if the end of life were amusement, and one were to take trouble and suffer hardship all one's life in order to amuse oneself. To exert oneself and work for the sake of amusement seems silly and utterly childish. But to amuse oneself, that one may exert oneself, seems right. For amusement is a sort of relaxation, and we need relaxation because we cannot work continuously. Work, in turn," he goes on to say, "is for the sake of leisure, as war is for the sake of peace. And happiness depends upon leisure more than upon anything else." And then, in another work of his, The Politics, he returns to this basic theme. And let me read you the other passage, which continues his thought and I think develops it. "Leisure and personal development," he says, "may be promoted not only by the virtues which are themselves practiced in leisure, but also by some of the virtues which are useful to business or work, for many necessities of life have to be provided before we can have leisure. Yet," he adds, "we need virtue not primarily in order to work well, but to use leisure well. For the first principle, the end or the goal of all human activity is leisure. Leisure is properly the enjoyment of life. It consists in doing the things which make a life worth living." Now to this, there is one point I would like to add. If Aristotle is right, if happiness consists in a virtuous conduct of one's work and a virtuous use of one's free time in leisure, then the two most prevalent of all human ills, the two most prevalent causes of human misery are these. One, not having the right sort of work to do, work that calls upon one's abilities and develops one. And two, having time in one's hands to kill or burn. The happy man, I would define as one who enjoys the work he is doing and has no time to kill or burn. Now let me turn then to the second main point of today's discussion. I turn from this ethical consideration of labor and leisure to social, political, and economic considerations, and to the great revolution which has taken place for the first time in our own day.
Dr. Adler.
Yes, Lloyd.
May I interrupt to ask you about something that's been bothering me? Now, from your reading of Aristotle, I think you've demonstrated clearly that the Greeks 2,500 years ago had a magnificent grasp of this concept of labor and leisure. Now, what do you mean, then, when you say, or at least imply or infer, as you just did, that we have revolutionized the understanding of these two concepts?
I'm glad you asked me that question, Lloyd. The revolution I am going to talk about is not so much a revolution in our understanding of labor and leisure as it is a revolution in the social, economic, and political realities concerned with labor and leisure. And I'm going to have to talk to you now about the facts. Turn from ideas to facts. I hope it is permissible for a philosopher to give up ideas for facts, because that's what I have to do now. The first of the two great revolutions, I think, that changed the whole course of human life and society, took place about 750 BC. And that revolution governed human life from 750 BC to 1750 AD, about the middle of the 18th century. That is the revolution that came about. That is the revolution that came about when the division of labor had reached a point where some few men had leisure, enough leisure to develop the arts and sciences, to create constitutions and republics, and act politically as citizens. This great change in the modes of production had, as I just indicated, two extraordinary effects on human life, one good and one bad. The good effect is the rise of cities. The men left family life and tribal life or village life and amalgamated in cities, and with the division of labor that existed in cities, they formed republics, became citizens, and had enough leisure to develop the arts and sciences. Just one more passage from Aristotle on this that I think is extraordinary. In the opening book of his Metaphysics, he says, "The arts and sciences, which do not aim at giving pleasure or at the necessities of life, were first discovered in the places where men began to have leisure. That is why the mathematical arts were first developed in Egypt, for there the priestly class was allowed to be at leisure." But the bad effect of this first revolution was that it divided men or society into two classes we've seen for several weeks now, a large laboring working class and a small leisure class. And it brought about the necessities of slave labor or servile labor. The second great revolution, and in my opinion, a much greater revolution than the first, took place around 1750, and it is running its course into our own day. That is the Industrial Revolution. This great change in the mode of production, from hand work to machine work, from manufacturing to machinifacturing, has revolutionized the conditions of labor and the distribution of leisure. And it has had, in my view, greater and more far-reaching results than the first revolution. But these results are both good and bad. The revolution itself has taken place very recently. It really has only matured in our own day. Let's look at the basic facts now. Let's look at the facts. First, let's consider the change in the sources of power in the last 100 years. The graph before you shows what this change is. In 1850, human and animal muscle produced 95% of the goods we use, and machine power only 5%. Whereas in 1950, 100 years later, machines produce 84% of the goods we use, and human and animal muscle only 16%. Yet, in that same time, as measured by 1940 prices, human productivity produced only 17 cents worth of goods per man hour in 1850, and produced 87 cents worth of goods per man hour of work in 1950. Let us turn now to another graph, which shows us the effect of this change upon the work week. I have not put in this graph the work week in 1850, but the facts are that in 1850,
men worked 70 hours or more a week. In 1890, the work week had dropped to 63 hours a week. In 1920, it had dropped to 51 hours a week. In 1950, it had dropped to 40, and the projection for the future is that in 1960, it'll be considerably less than 40 hours a week. Though this happened, it was accompanied by an increasing productivity, as you've seen, per man hour of work, and this indicates the extraordinary change in both production and in leisure. Now, the effect upon education is marked in the chart on the right, as you look at it. These are only some of the facts about education, but they, I think, are indicative of all the other facts. The figures show you the percentage of 14 to 17-year-olds in high school. In 1890, only 6.7% of the 14 to 17-year-olds were in high school. In 1920, almost 40%, 37.9% were in high school. And in 1950, 70% of our 14 to 17-year-olds were in high school. Look, let's look at one more graph together, a graph which shows the political effect of this extraordinary change. In 1850, 16% of the population voted. In 1920, 25% of the population voted. In 1950, 39% of the population voted. And even more striking are the figures that in 1890, only 29% of the population were registered to vote. In 1920, 51% of the population registered to vote. And in 1950, 65% of the population registered to vote. And these facts would be even more striking if we had before us the facts for the years 1850 to 1870 and 1870 to 1890. Now let's turn from these extraordinarily significant facts and figures to the basic results of the Industrial Revolution. I have charted here the good effects of the Industrial Revolution. And you can see it by making the comparison with me. In all the pre-industrial societies of the past, society was divided into a laboring and leisure class. Whereas with the industrial economy of our own day, we have a classless society of free men who both are workers and men of leisure. All the pre-industrial economies of the past were aristocratic in political form. The rule was in the hands of the few. Only with an industrial economy do we have democracy and universal suffrage. In all the pre-industrial economies of the past, only leisure and a few learned professions have dignity. Whereas in the industrial democracy of the present, all forms of human labor have dignity. In all the pre-industrial aristocracies of the past, most men, being slaves and hirelings, had only a two-part life of sleep and work. Whereas in the industrial democracy of the present, all men who are citizens, workers, and men with leisure have the possibility of a four-part life. A possibility. But yet, only a possibility, because, unfortunately, the Industrial Revolution, which has these good consequences, carries with it some bad effects also. And I would now like to have you consider with me what the bad effects of the Industrial Revolution is, so that we can see the balance of good and bad together. This last chart enumerates the four bad consequences or evils of industrialization. Let me read and explain what I have put into this chart. The first and most serious consequence is the routinization and trivialization of productive tasks, the elimination from the labor of many men on the assembly line in highly organized factories where machines do the great part of the work, the elimination from their life of the pleasure and the value of craftsmanship, of individual craftsmanship. The second great evil of industrialization is the widespread fallacy, particularly in America today, that productivity is the end of life, that the producing of more and more goods is the end of all our efforts, whereas, in fact, we ought to regard the increase in productivity only as a means and not as an end. And when, as a consequence, when men look upon productivity as an end, there's a further consequence, because this has the effect of making many people think that free time should be used only for play and recreation in order to get back to work and produce more. And those who take part in leisure properly are often looked upon as dilettantes. There's a tendency on the part of workers with leisure to use their free time for play or recreation because of the emphasis on productivity. And finally, as a consequence of the Industrial Revolution and the industrialization of our society in every way, there has come about what I've indicated here in this last line, the deterioration or disappearance of liberal education. And this is the greatest misfortune of all, because it is only through liberal education that we can hope to correct or overcome the other evil consequences of industrialization and realize the good possibilities of the Industrial Revolution.
Dr. Adler.
Yes, Lord.
I've got to interrupt you once more, and this time as an educator, because to me there's an apparent paradox here, and if I see it, I think perhaps maybe it might disturb some of our viewers as well. Now, on the one hand, just a few moments ago, you pointed out very clearly the effects of the Industrial Revolution, which was to make possible the increase of schooling, more schooling for more children and more time for the individual child. Now you're pointing out that industrialization has ruined education. Now, it would seem to me that it's done the very, very opposite to ruining education, and I think then that you must have either something more in mind or there is this paradox.
Well, I think there is this paradox, Lloyd, but I think it's only apparent. On the one hand, industrialization, the basic changes in labor and leisure, have made it possible for the first time to give liberal education to all children and all adults. This is what the facts on the graphs you looked at a moment ago show. On the other hand, while the quantity of education has increased for all and for each, the quality of education has diminished. It has become less and less liberal. And this, Lloyd, is my basic point, that education for all must become more and more liberal if we are going to realize the possibilities, the good possibilities inherent in the Industrial Revolution, the political possibilities for democratic citizenship, and the ethical possibilities for the best use of leisure and the good or happy life. Now, that's our subject for the next time. Next time, we want to deal with the problem of liberal education in an industrial democracy, in which all men are citizens and all men have leisure to use well or waste. And whether they use it well or waste it is finally up to liberal education. That is the problem of liberal education in an industrial democracy. And I hope you will send your questions in on liberal education in relation to labor and leisure. Thank you very much. Mr. Luckman and I welcome you to another discussion of the great ideas. This afternoon, we conclude the discussion of labor by considering the problem of liberal education in relation to labor and leisure. Last week's discussion of the Industrial Revolution as its effects upon the organization of labor and the distribution of leisure prepares for our consideration of education this afternoon. Let me remind you of the main conclusions we reached. We saw the great advantages that accrued to men and to societies from the Industrial Revolution that took place largely in the last 100 years. We saw how in the industrial mode of production broke down, almost abolished, the sharp distinction between a working class and a leisure class. We saw the effect it had on establishing for the first time the dignity of all forms of labor. And we saw the political effect, how as men became emancipated from grinding toil and had the leisure to do so, there was some sense in giving them the rights of suffrage and the duties of citizenship. But we also saw last time two great evil consequences of the Industrial Revolution. We saw how as free time increased, men tended to misuse this free time by using it for recreational play instead of for genuinely leisure activities. And we also, at least, faced the statement that I made last time, that with these changes, there was a progressive deterioration in liberal education. Mr. Luckman challenged that last statement of mine by pointing to the obvious facts that in the last 50 years, with the rapidly increasing Industrial Revolution, education was on the increase. It seemed to be improving, not deteriorating. Let's look at the facts for a moment so that I can once more make a comment on Mr. Luckman's point. The statistics I read last week were, of course, entirely from the United States. They apply only to a very advanced industrial country, not to the backward portions of the world. So today my statistics come from American facts and figures. In 1900, there were less than 10% of the children between the ages of 14 and 17 in high school, whereas in 1950, there were more than 70% of that age group in high school. At the time of World War I, 75% or more of the draftees had had 8 years or less than 8 years of schooling, whereas at the time of World War II, 20 years later, 68% of the draftees had had 9 years of schooling or more, and 39% had had 12 years of schooling or more, as compared with only 9.5% 20 years earlier. In the first 50 years of this century, the number of teachers and the number of schools doubled and redoubled many times, and with this, of course, the appropriations to cover the cost of education. Now, Lloyd, it seems to me that what these facts show is that schooling has been on the increase. But if you look at the facts, it's clearly that this is a quantitative improvement, not a qualitative improvement. If we ask ourselves, what about the quality of education in the last 50 years? Has that improved? It seems to me, there, Lloyd, the sad fact is that as schooling has increased more and more, education has deteriorated, for it has become less and less liberal. And if we put the emphasis upon the word liberal, then we understand, I think, the point about the deterioration of education in the last 50 years. Now that brings us to the main point of this afternoon's discussion. And I think we can start, Lloyd, with two questions we received. One from Ms. Cavanaugh, I think, and one from Mr. Starkey.
Yes, that's right. Here's the one from Mrs. Cavanaugh. She's a resident of Livermore. She says, since so many connotations attach themselves to the term liberal, will you please preface your discussion with an explanation of the term as applied to education?
I certainly am glad that you restricted her question. Glad you restricted your question, Ms. Cavanaugh, to liberal as applied to education. For to define a liberal in the political sense as a name for one of the great parties or positions contrasted with the conservative position or the radical position is very difficult indeed. You probably have heard the definition of a liberal that is given either by the conservative or by the radical who doesn't like the liberal. He says the liberal is a man with both feet squarely planted in midair. But to explain what liberal means as applied to education is not so difficult. In fact, one catches the meaning immediately that one recognizes that the word liberal has the same root that the word liberty has. And that root means, in Latin, free. And so, you can define liberal education by saying it is education for free men. It is the education of free men, and for their use of freedom. The freedom they have to use because they belong to the ruling class in society and because they belong to the leisure class in society. I think that is a perfectly clear definition of what liberal means as applied to education.
Well, now with that in mind, then, we can go on to this second question, which follows quite hard on Ms. Cavanaugh's question, Dr. Adler. And I think it may be harder for you to answer it so briefly. It comes from Mr. Elmer Starkey of Petaluma. Very short and sweet. He says, just what does a liberal education consist in? And that's all Mr. Starkey wants to know.
That question, Mr. Starkey, calls for a book, not a sentence or two. And because it calls for a book, I'm going to recommend some books which you and others may be interested to read on the subject of what liberal education consists in. I have here a list, long list of books about liberal education from the 5th century B.C. down to our own day. I'm only going to recommend four written by Americans, three Americans, that I think are excellent on the subject. One is the book by John Dewey, the great book at the beginning of the century, Democracy and Education, published in 1916. And then a book by Mark Van Doren in 1943 called simply Liberal Education. And then two books by my friend Robert M. Hutchins, one in 1943 called Education for Freedom, and one published only last year called The Conflict in Education. Now that doesn't answer your question, Mr. Starkey, but let me see if I can, in two sentences, this will be brief and inadequate, but let me try in two sentences to say what liberal education consists in. I would say, first, in school, liberal education consists in acquiring the disciplines of learning, learning how to learn, and then in becoming acquainted for the first time with the ideas that one must spend a lifetime in trying to understand. And I would say, second, that in adult life, liberal education consists in using the liberal arts, which are the disciplines of learning, the disciplines acquired in school, to carry on the process of learning in the lifelong pursuit of understanding, insight, and wisdom. Now, with these two questions answered, Lloyd, I think I can state my two main propositions, the ones I should like to explain and perhaps even defend against objection. My two main propositions are, first, that the universal distribution of leisure and suffrage that accompanies industrialization requires an industrial democracy to give liberal schooling to all the children who are going to grow into free men and women, free in the sense of having leisure time, free in the sense of being citizens. And my second proposition is that because the purpose of this liberal schooling is to prepare these children for the use of the leisure they will have when they grow up, and because leisure itself, one of its main uses, is to continue learning, my second proposition is that liberal learning must continue throughout an adult life as one of the main uses of leisure. Now, I think that these two things are requirements of an industrial democracy. Will be clear to anyone who keeps before him the understanding of labor and leisure as we have been discussing these basic terms for the last 4 weeks. But to be sure that this is clear, because I think it makes a great deal of difference to have these two propositions as clear and more than clear seem to be true, as they possibly may be seen to be true, I would like to give you a graphic demonstration of their truth. I have a series of charts which my son Mark made for me that I think clearly make this proposition quite clear. The first chart considers the character of education in all the pre-industrial aristocracies of the past. Let's look at it together. In all the pre-industrial aristocracies of the past, education was only for the few, that few being a leisure class and a ruling class. And that education for the few of free men, consisted of liberal schooling and adult liberal learning. There was no education for the many at all. There was no need to educate disfranchised slaves and workers. They had no freedom. They had no leisure. They were not citizens. They needed no education. All that they received was training on the job. And of course, there was no learning, no time for learning in their adult life. Now, I want to stress three things in this chart. I want to stress the fact that in all the pre-industrial aristocracies of the past, education was liberal education. One didn't talk about some education being liberal and some being vocational. Education was liberal education. One didn't talk of vocational training as education at all. It was the training of workers or slaves. And when one conceived education itself as essentially liberal, one saw that it could not be accomplished in school, that it could only be begun in school, that the main points and purposes of liberal education had to be fully accomplished in adult life. Now then think of what the principles are that are shown in this chart. That education is liberal when it is for the free, and its purpose for the free is enable them to use their leisure well and to perform their duties as members of a ruling class. If one understands the principles of that chart, I think the principles of that chart are clear, then one can imagine what education should be like in an industrial democracy. What should we expect of education in an industrial democracy? Well, my second chart indicates what we should expect of education in an industrial democracy. In an industrial democracy in which all men are citizens, and as citizens, members of the ruling class, they are citizen rulers, and in which they are all not merely workers, but free workers, workers with the dignity of labor, and therefore with leisure. In such a society, one would expect that there'd be liberal schooling for all, and there'd be opportunities and provisions for liberal learning in adult life for all. That follows like the night the day, for if the principles of the first chart were true and clear, this is the way they would be applied to an industrial democracy in which the main shift is from the few who are free to all men who are free as men with leisure and as citizens. But, is this the situation in America today, the most advanced industrial democracy in the world? Does this chart describe what education is like in America today? I'm sorry to say the answer to that question is no. What we find instead is this. We find that in the United States of America in the first half of the 20th century, between 1900 and 1950, what we have achieved is approximately 8 years of common schooling, ordinary elementary schooling for all children, which by itself is, I think, woefully insufficient as preparation for citizenship and leisure. And past the eighth grade, we divide our children. We give liberal schooling, and I'm sorry to say it isn't too good at that, but liberal schooling for a minority in the liberal arts high schools and colleges, many of which are not liberal enough. But for the majority, for most of the children, after they leave elementary school, we give them vocational training in school instead of on the job. And we certainly have, I think, clearly inadequate provisions for the liberal education for adults in the country where most adults have an enormous amount of leisure. Now, this chart shows how American education in the first half of the 20th century, in which the Industrial Revolution has matured and given us the opportunities we have not used, how American education fails, in reality, to conform to the ideal that you saw on the chart just preceding. I think one can understand why that failure took place. The problem of giving liberal education to all the children, which is required in an industrial democracy, is a very difficult problem. Much more difficult than any problem that educators have ever faced in the history of mankind. And that problem hit American education with a suddenness for which they were unprepared, so that they hardly saw the problem as it overtook them, and in some sense swamped them. This, I think, excuses American educators for the first 25 or 30 years of the century from not doing what should have been done. But what is inexcusable, in my judgment, is the fact that now, 50 years after the turn of the century, American educators are still not facing the problem. They are still permitting this division between liberal schooling for the few and vocational training for the many to be prevalent, widely prevalent in our school system. They are still not facing the problem. They are running away from it, when in fact this problem cannot be solved unless it's faced and dwelt upon. I do not mean to imply that I know the solution to the problem. In fact, I would say there is no American educator who at the moment knows how to solve this problem. All that can be said is what is required for its solution. We must somehow discover by hard thought and patient effort, the ways and means of giving all the children the same kind of education, the liberal education that was given to the select few in all the pre-industrial aristocracies of the past.
Dr. Adler.
Yes, Lloyd.
I agree with you about the problem we must solve, and also what's required to solve it. But I know a very great many educators and many teachers, too, who wouldn't agree with you. And I'm just wondering how you would answer their objection.
What is their objection? They only have one objection, Lloyd?
No, I'm sure that you know very well that they have many objections. But there is one that goes to the very heart of this particular matter. It's simply that the facts, again, are against you. Now, here we have this problem, that most of the children, or at least half of them, just haven't the capability of profiting by a liberal education. And therefore, we're faced with the choice of providing vocational training for those children who do not profit by the liberal education.
Lloyd, I think that is a basic misstatement. People who say that are misunderstanding the democratic maxim of equal educational opportunity. They think the maxim is correctly stated when they say we give equal educational opportunity to all the children because we give them equal amounts of schooling. That is an incorrect understanding of the maxim, I think. The correct interpretation of that maxim is that equal educational opportunity means the opportunity for all the children not merely to have the same amount of schooling, but to enjoy receiving the same kind or quality of schooling. And that quality must be liberal. And I say, Lloyd, that all the facts, which I'm willing to admit, certainly must admit, all the facts of individual differences do not change in one bit, in one particular, the principle I've just stated. Let me show you that. I have here two containers. Here is a quart container. Here is a pint container. Let the quart container represent the quart-sized child, the child with a quart-sized capacity for receiving liberal education. Let the pint container represent the pint-sized child, the child with a pint-sized capacity for receiving liberal education. Now, what does the democratic maxim of equal educational opportunity for all the children mean? Does it mean putting merely the quantity of liquid these two containers can receive into them, putting cream into the large container and milk or skim milk or water, into the small container? For as compared with education, vocational training is mere water. No, it does not mean that. What we are required to do with these two unequal containers representing the unequal gifts of natural endowment is to put the same kind of liquid in both, a quart of cream. If we can manufacture the cream of education, a quart of cream into the quart container and a pint of cream into the pint container. That is treating the two children equal. Now I say, that American education today is as wrong in principle as Thomas Jefferson was in 1817, as undemocratic in principle as Thomas Jefferson was in 1817 when he proposed to the Virginia legislature a bill to give all the children of Virginia 3 years of common schooling up to, no more than that. And then beyond the third year, he suggested dividing them into those who were destined for labor. They would be sent out of school to the farms, to the shops as apprentices. And those destined for leisure and for politics, they would go on to college. Are we much better than that today? Yes. In one sense, we are. We give 8 years of common schooling, but that merely is the result of the Industrial Revolution. We give 8 years of common schooling, but after that, we divide the children just as Thomas Jefferson would have us divide them into those destined for labor and those destined for leisure and for rule, whereas, in fact, they're all destined for leisure and for political life. The ideal we must face is to give all the children not merely 8 years of common schooling, but adequate liberal training, liberal schooling, through high school, and I would go further and say through college, all the children up to and through a Bachelor of Arts degree, which is the training, the education they should receive in preparation for their role in the life of freedom, the use of their own leisure, and the performance of their political duties. Now, I have to face the facts. If that ideal cannot be realized, then we ought to give democracy up, give it up entirely, and return to the aristocratic forms of society in which the free were separated from the slaves. The men with leisure and the ruling classes were separated from the disfranchised many who were slaves or workers. Because, I say to you, to give suffrage and leisure to those who are incapable of liberal education is dangerous to society and dangerous to the men themselves who have this leisure and are not educated to use it. I don't think that's the case. I think all men can receive liberal education. But if they can't, then we ought to give democracy up.
Well, Dr. Adler, again, let's suppose that this ideal that you're stating can be realized, however far off that realization might be. But there's still another difficult problem to solve here, and it's in a question that I have. It's about the relationship of liberal education to labor this time, not to leisure.
Yes. Glad we make that shift, as a matter of fact, Lloyd.
Mr. Nelson, I think, points it out very well, Dr. Adler, when he asks you, if everyone is liberally educated, he says, what are we going to do about the menial and disagreeable tasks that no one with a liberal education would then want to work at?
Lloyd, I think that the question is an very good one. Mr. Nelson asks the question that is always asked. I've talked to many audiences about liberal education over the years, and it is interesting how, when you propose the possibility, the ideal that all the children will go to college someday, that they all will get a liberal schooling in which there's no vocational training whatsoever, they'll all be prepared for a life of leisure and of citizenship, someone in the audience always asks the question, Mr. Nelson, and what are you going to do then about the lower tasks, the less pleasant tasks, the more menial tasks in the hierarchy of tasks that constitutes the division of labor in a complex industrial society? Now, there's one answer to the question. I think, in fact, there are two. But let me give you the first answer. It's suggested to us, Lloyd, by one of our correspondents, Mr. Edward C. Keechy, who I think teaches industrial engineering.
Yes, he is an industrial
engineer. At Berkeley, yeah. University of California. And Mr. Keechy, in this letter, a week ago, suggests that the automatic or push-button factory of the future will do away with a great many repetitive manual jobs and so eliminate a great deal of drudgery from the labor men have to do. But that's only part of the answer, Mr. Nelson. The other part is that the scale of individual differences will remain unchanged after all individuals are liberally educated up to their capacity, the quart-size capacity or the pint-size capacity. So there always will be human inequality, and that human inequality will somehow always fit the hierarchy of tasks, even when many menial tasks have been removed by the push-button factory and labor has been liberalized and all workers are liberally educated. I don't think there's any problem about the fitting of men into the complex hierarchy of tasks that a society requires. Lloyd, I think we have time for one more question.
Very well. Mr. Asturias of Oakland, California, wants you to tell him whether women should have the same sort of liberal education as men in our industrial age.
Mr. Asturias, that, again, is a question, I think, very good. It's familiar. It's a question that's asked again and again, is it not? One thing we should face at once. Are women citizens? Do women have leisure? Even when they work. Even when they have housework to do. Or when they're office working. If they are citizens, and if they have leisure, then they need liberal education just as much as men do. But I always like to say one more thing here. If women don't work, and I suppose, Lloyd, there are some women who don't work, either housework or any other kind of work, they have more leisure than any man in an industrial society has, and therefore women who don't work need liberal education even more than men do. For liberal education is an indispensable condition of their being saved from the misuse of their free time and their having the ways of using it.
Well, I can't think of a better way to end a discussion than on the idea of empowering women and educating them. Can you? Very good stuff. I hope you've followed through to the end here and have enjoyed it. I imagine some of you might have some questions, some disagreements, and I would love to hear them. Send them in, thenextsteppodcast@gmail.com. I've thought a lot about what he says in this talk, and I more or less agree with pretty much everything he says about it. You know, I do think that there's some new perspectives coming through that still might not even change much of what he says. You know, I'm thinking more of like engaging more in the works of permaculture and things like that. And, you know, really, if you think about it, that is permaculture. If you were able to do it full time, would be work, but also leisure. You know, it's affecting society. It's creating art. It's engaging with others, community, friendship, you know, duties of citizenship. And it's also a bit of play at times, from what I can tell. it's a bit scary to think, if you take seriously what he says about liberal education, it's a bit scary to think that he was saying those things in the mid-1950s. And here we are, 2011. And as far as education goes, at least in the United States, it hasn't gotten any better, and in fact has gotten tremendously worse. Certainly that's my own opinion, but I think there's something to back that up. And we're going to get into this whole discussion of liberal education in the next episode. So if you're interested in this idea and this information so far, stay tuned for the next episode. Should be coming up very soon. And I'm going to just present to the audience, along with the help of Mortimer Adler, you know, basically a way of looking at liberal education fitted for the modern society, the modern mind. I have no idea how Mortimer Adler would respond to my presentation if he were alive still today. I imagine he would at least find it charming and somewhat informative. But again, you know, as I said in the beginning, I think liberal education has meant many different things at many different times, and certain emphasis have been placed in one time that is not placed in another. And as you'll see, I have done, I think, some pretty decent work in explaining it to a 21st century crowd. So again, it is, I think, if you follow what he says about liberal education, it is pretty damn scary to think about the situation now. The schools are a mess. Education is horrible. Kids are not learning how to think. They're not learning how to learn. Kids are only learning how to become good workers. And what happens? You work, and then you come home and you play, and you rest. Our society is full of so many distractions. And then all of these horrible, you know, things are happening around us with corruption and deception and poverty and sickness, all these things that require the attention of the citizenry, you know. They require our attention. But so many of us are playing video games and, you know, worrying about, you know, how we're going to dress up our steaks, what football game is playing, are they going to play football this year, you know, what new toys did we get, where's our wave runner, where's our boat, you know, we're focused on so many of these things that entertain us, and if not, we're worried about our comfort, new couches, new beds, nice houses, nice homes, mow the lawn, you know, all these things. This is the life outside of work. We work for this life of rest and play. And I've always looked for a way of understanding this intuition that I've had that there's another category of activities that we need to be engaging in, and seriously so. You know, and I think leisure provides that. It's really hard for me still to kind of say the word leisure and mean immediately what Mortimer Adler has to say, because again, I've always considered leisure a combination of rest and play. So it is a bit strange, but I can't think of a better term. And you know, this is sort of a historical term. It's got some history to it, and I would like to see more people start using this term in that way and understanding it as such, because again, it's a distinction. It's a category we can understand and we can share with others. Talking about one way to use our free time, you know, it's giving us something more than just the pursuit of creature comforts and amusement, and you know, it's giving us more than that, and it's saying, well, there's a lot of other work that can be done, let's get doing it, you know. Just the idea of bringing art into the picture here, that's great. You know, not just doodling necessarily. I mean, let's think of art outside of the canvas, outside of the art room. Let's think of art in our communities. What kind of art can we create together? You know, maybe not even works of art that get hung up on the wall, but moments of art, you know? Let's have an event that itself is a work of art created by the people in the community. That's something I'm more interested in. And damn it, you know, it's so hard to do in these towns that we live in that are just not structured for it at all. There's no real good places in most of American suburbs and even urban areas and farming towns where it's just the landscape itself invites the creation of community art, momentary art, you know, living art. It's really tough. And I'm really interested in this idea, as you can tell. So anyway, enough rambling from me. I hope you enjoyed it. Again, please give me some feedback if you have any, if you have some time to send me an email when you're at the computer and you might remember to do so. I know a lot of people have that where they listen to a podcast or at work or they're at the gym or something and they want to respond to something they hear, but you know, the day goes on and you forget, and maybe when you're at the computer you don't have the energy or you just kind of forgot what it was that you wanted to say. But in any case, if you can find yourself with the time and the energy and the will, and you're at the computer, drop me a note. I'd love to hear from you guys. Definitely don't hear from enough, and that's just how podcasting goes, and I accept that. But I know you're out there. People are downloading the show, and it's always kind of a slow progress, more people downloading it all the time. No big numbers here, but that's not what I'm going for. It's all about quality, you know, quality in people, quality in audience. I don't care if the masses are hearing the message. They won't listen anyway. But you're here. You are here, and you have something to say, whether you're going to say it to me or you're going to say it to your loved ones or the people around you. You have something to do. You have art to create. You have a life to create. Yeah? Beauty. And maybe while you're doing that, maybe you'll also get compensated and make a few bucks. You know? Combine the old work and leisure. Wouldn't that be nice? Well, until next time, I'm signing off here. You can catch me in the next episode where I'm going to talk about liberal education and what it means to a 21st century modern industrial information era society. I'm not going to say everything that there is to say about it. I'm still learning a lot myself, but I've learned quite a bit so far, at least enough to bring you in. So if you followed the idea so far, if you're interested in what liberal education might offer you, I do encourage you to tune in next time, and hopefully you will not be disappointed. I think at least you will be informed. Alrighty then, take it easy.
You may find yourself living in a shotgun shack, and you may find yourself in another part of the world, and you may find yourself behind the wheel of a large automobile, and you may find yourself in a beautiful house with a beautiful wife. You may ask yourself, well, how did I get here?
Letting the days go by, let the water hold me down. Letting the days go by, water flowing underground into the blue again. After the money's gone, once in a lifetime, water flowing underground.
And you may ask yourself, how do I work this? And you may ask yourself, where is that large automobile? And you may tell yourself, this is not my beautiful house. And you may tell yourself, this is not my beautiful wife.
Letting the days go by, let the water hold me down. Letting the days go by, water flowing underground. Into the blue again, after the money's gone. Once in a lifetime, water flowing underground.
Same as it ever was, same as it ever was.